do we have Commissioner Novick?
His eyes.
Oh, he's right there. Okay. You want to read the 3 o'clock item, Carla?
Mm-hmm. Item 1335, adopt the City of Portland's Vision Zero Action Plan Vision Zero Action Plan, Saving Lives with Safe Streets, developed by the Vision Zero Task Force.
Commissioner Novick.
Colleagues, we're pleased to have this opportunity to ask Council to adopt the Vision Zero Action Plan. The Vision Zero Action Plan represents a thorough citywide analysis of one of the largest public health threats the residents of our city face, traffic crashes. During this process, we worked with a 26-member task force, including representatives of Oregon Walks, the Black Parent Initiative, Disability Rights Oregon, Portland Police Bureau, Fire Bureau, Legacy Emanuel Trauma Services, AARP, the American Automobile Association, and TriMet. The task force was supplemented with the Vision Zero Executive Committee comprised of elected officials and agency heads. There was also a technical advisory committee which provided input on data, design, analysis, and outreach. In short, there has been a significant amount of community input into this plan. This plan outlines steps that we need to take as a city to get zero fatalities. We know this work will not happen overnight. It will require continued public engagement, building on meaningful partnerships and support from the council. It will require equipping the Portland Bureau of Transportation with resources necessary to implement street designs we know will save lives. And right now, we have to acknowledge that we are swimming against the current. Very sadly, so far this year, we've had 37 traffic-related fatalities on streets within the city of Portland. 2016 has been a particularly deadly year. This is part of a national trend. In the past 2 years throughout the United States, we've seen for the first time in a long time a significant increase in traffic fatalities. And national experts are still trying to figure that out. One of the leading assumed culprits is the use of cell phones. And it's my understanding that technology is on the way or already exists to disable cell phones when people are driving, and I hope that we see the swift development and implementation of that technology. Speed, impairment, and distraction continue to be deadly. And I have to say that although it's sort of nice to know that it's not just our problem, this is part of a national trend, I mean, it's sort of reassuring in one way, in another way, it's not reassuring at all. It's terrible to know that we've seen an increase in fatalities, not just in Portland, but around the country. And the fact that we're a part of a national trend is no comfort to the parents, siblings, children, and friends of those that we've lost. Before I turn this over to staff, I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce two amendments to this ordinance. And let's see, we've got copies to distribute. And both of these amendments were recommended by Commissioner Fritz. Amendment 1, add to the ordinance findings, finding 9. On November 8, 2016, Portland voters approved Measure 26180, a 3% tax on recreational marijuana sales, estimated to provide $3 million per year. Commissioner Fritz assures me that it's going to be more than that. And one of the designated uses of revenue for this tax is public safety improvements to reduce impacts of drug and alcohol abuse, such as police DUII training and enforcement, support for firefighter paramedics, street projects that improve safety, and other initiatives to reduce the impact of drug and alcohol abuse. Amendment 2 is a direction to PBOT, amending an existing direction. The existing direction says the Bureau of Transportation shall report back on safety performance as requested by council. This amendment would change that to annually and as requested by council. To elaborate on the reasoning behind these amendments, when voters approved the marijuana tax in November 2016, they approved using that revenue in part on, quote, street projects that improve safety. The goal of the First Amendment is to clarify that revenue from the marijuana tax can be used for street improvement projects related to Vision Zero. For the Second Amendment, PBOT initially suggested a report back to council on an as-requested basis. Mr. Fritz said that Vision Zero is important enough to warrant an annual report to council, whether council spontaneously requested or not, and we agreed that was a very good idea. I want to thank Commissioner Fritz for suggesting both of these amendments.
And I second them.
Yes, and thank you for seconding them. This is the type of feedback that will make our city's commitment to Vision Zero even stronger. I'm very glad the new marijuana tax revenue could be a potential funding source for these priorities. I want to thank all of the people who participated in this plan, including Clay Vaca, Dana Dickman, Margie Bradway, Leah Treat, Tamur Ender, the task force members, members of the public who provided input, the city bureaus who engaged with PBOT to develop this plan, and members of other council members, the mayor's staff. Now I'd like to turn it over to Director Treat, Margie Bradway, and Clay Vaca for the presentation.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Although this is a pretty heavy subject, I think, for all of us, it's very important. And I'm very happy that we're here to talk about an action plan and not just current circumstances. So the completion of this plan, it does represent a pretty significant milestone for us in our efforts to eliminate fatalities and serious injuries and crashes on our streets. We spent the better part of a year engaging in a very unprecedented level of collaboration with sister agencies in the city and also throughout the region and with community stakeholders. We had a very diverse range of professional and personal experience in the 26-member task force that brought to the table over the course of a year. We, in particular, are very appreciative of the partnership that we have with the Portland Police Bureau and the Fire Bureau in our planning and implementation. The most important word in this report that you have before you today for us is action. It's not a plan that we're going to put on the shelf. This is a plan that we are going to be using, and this plan is already guiding steps that we're taking to make Portland's streets safer for everyone. Each year, more than 30,000 people, that's the population of a small city, are needlessly killed on our streets, and thousands more are injured. Last year, 37 people died on Portland streets. Unfortunately, as of yesterday morning, we've already exceeded that number, and we're at 38, and we still have a month to go in the year. So what you have before you is a roadmap for a much safer future. It details the specific steps we need to take to get to zero, and it presents clear performance measures so that we can all hold ourselves accountable. When this city council passed our Vision Zero ordinance last June, Portland was, with San Francisco and New York, only one of three Vision Zero cities in the country. In the past year, the momentum behind Vision Zero has grown, and Portland is now part of a national network of 20 cities that have embraced the Vision Zero goal. In fact, Portland was also selected last January to be part of a select group of 10 cities called the Vision Zero Focus Cities, and we're informing the national conversation on safety, and we're learning from each other. As part of the Focus Cities, we're learning from our peers, and we are sharing best practices. One area where Portland is leading is in equity. And that's definitely in thanks to the part of the leadership of our task force. Equity is our guiding principle. In our Vision Zero action plan, we specifically state we are committed to not causing racial profiling as part of our plan. Other cities like San Francisco are now looking to us for guidance on how to incorporate equity into their Vision Zero programs. Portland has set the national bar for equity with our action plan. The task force has identified actions that are going to prioritize investments in traditionally underinvested areas and has committed to actions that are not going to lead to racial profiling. And as I mentioned, we're committed to taking action to make our streets safer. I'm so grateful that you all have already made decisions to invest in the safety of Portlanders traveling on our streets, helping jumpstart our efforts to move on the 32 actions identified in the plan. In October, thank you, you allocated funding for critical safety improvements on one of Portland's most dangerous streets, Northeast Halsey, from 114th to 162nd. Your investment is going to build sidewalks, protected bike lanes, install rapid flashing beacons, and upgrade pedestrian crossings. This is a project that the community prioritized in the East Portland in Motion and the East Portland Action Plan, and is one that rises to the very top of our Vision Zero data analysis. In addition, we have begun rolling out Oregon's first-ever speed safety camera program. The first cameras were installed on Southwest Beaverton-Hillsdale Highway in September, and additional cameras are going to be installed on three other streets in the High Crash Network in 2017. The Beaverton-Hillsdale Highway Camera has already seen a stunning success and has helped reduce speeding on this thoroughfare by 95%. We will be working with our partners, the Police Bureau and the Multnomah Circuit Courts, to expand Portland's effective red light camera program. There are several bills that the state legislature will consider this session that we believe are critical to Vision Zero's success: gaining local authority to set speeds on our streets, strengthening Oregon's distracted driving laws, and securing state-level transportation funding that has a strong safety focus. We do have a lot of work ahead of us, but thanks to your leadership and to the commitment of our stakeholders and other Portlanders, I am confident that we're going to make the vision of zero deaths and serious injuries on our streets a reality. Next, I'm going to turn it over to Margie Bradway to walk you through the process, and Clay Vaca, the project manager for the Vision Zero Action Plan, to hit on the highlights in the plan. And lastly, but most importantly, we are going to hear testimony from some of our task force members. All right, Margie.
Hi, I'm Margie Bradway. I'm the Active Transportation Safety Division Manager. Thank you, Leah. I'm just going to walk through the process and remind you where we've been on Vision Zero. So on June 17th, 2015, over a year ago, this council adopted a resolution that announced that we as a citywide effort, adopt the goal of Vision Zero, that no loss of life is acceptable on our city streets. At the same time, when that resolution was passed, we were also directed to form a task force. Around that same time, unfortunately, Mayor Hales is not here, but I wanted to thank him for his effort. He led at the U.S. Mayors of Council to adopt a Vision Zero policy that he worked with on San Francisco's mayor. The task force has met six times. There was a larger task force that was also formed by a technical advisory committee that had representatives, as Leah and Commissioner have noted, members of the community, as well as technical experts from police, fire, health department, metro, TriMet, many experts in this area. During those meetings, we looked at all the data. We looked at several data sets, 10 years of data. We researched best practices, and then with the committee, and this is a highly dedicated, highly engaged committee, we prioritized the actions that you see in the plan. So before you today, to clarify what we are asking you to do, in addition to the amendments that Commissioner Novick walked through, we're asking you to adopt by ordinance the Vision Zero plan. We are directing PBOT to make sure that plan is consistent with the transportation system plan. And I want to note that we have adopted already in June a Vision Zero goal in the comprehensive plan, so that's consistent with the Vision Zero goal. Also asking us to direct the Vision Zero Task Force continue those meetings, although we recommend we go to quarterly meetings rather than monthly. And then at last, we welcome Commissioner Frenz's amendment to report back on safety performance on an annual basis. So with that, I think I'll just hit on a few slides. Or did I jump? Are we good?
I flipped through it.
Okay. Already. Good. Okay. I think we're there, and I think last but not least, could not have asked for a better project manager on this plan. I'm getting all choked up. Clay Vaca did such a wonderful job, and just put your hands up if you're part of the project team. We had a great consultant team. Thanks. Thank you, consultant team. And then members of the task force, can you put your hands up? Thank you so much. So we just had this great project team. Thank you to CH2M Hill. Thank you to DKS. Thank you to all of our technical experts, and thank you so much for this task force. I've been working in government a long time, and I'll say this is one of the best committees I've ever worked with and one of the best project teams I've ever worked with. So with that, thank you, and handing it off to Clay.
Thanks, Margie. Let's see here. There we go. The Vision Zero Task Force spent some very thoughtful time developing this vision statement, and every word in it is intentional. Working together, we will take equitable and data-driven actions that will eliminate deaths and serious injuries for all who share Portland streets by 2025. I'm going to pull out just a couple of components of this statement that were meaningful in particular. The first words, working together.
It states that it takes all of us, and this is important with Vision Zero as such a bold goal. It's not just people who drive. It's not just transportation experts or advocates. It's all of us Portlanders working together. The data-driven and equitable are key components to the statement, and they really guided the work every step of the way, and I'm going to hit on that in just a moment. And then by 2025, the task force chose to set an aggressive timeline in order to underscore the urgency and immediacy of the work that's needed in order to get to the goal. Looking at crash trends in Portland over time, we recognize that people moving about by all modes are impacted by these serious crashes, and particularly pedestrians. The project team analyzed 10 years of traffic crash data to understand the where and the what of these crashes. Where are the traffic deaths and serious injuries taking place on Portland's transportation network? And what is causing these serious crashes? Let's start with the where. Looking at the recent crash data, the project team identified the streets and intersections with the highest number of fatal and serious injury crashes. The task force, as well as the Vision Zero Technical Advisory Committee, reviewed the data and helped develop the methodology. We broke traffic crash data down by mode, identifying the 20 highest crash streets for people driving, the 20 highest crash streets for people walking, and those for people bicycling. Then we layered those streets on top of each other, and the result was a total of 30 streets that make up the Portland's high crash network. So, defying math logic, 20 plus 20 plus 20 equals 30, and that's due to the significant overlap of streets on each of the lists. For instance, streets like Division, Gleason, and many others showed up on the high crash map for people walking, biking, and driving. Additionally, the team identified the 30 highest crash intersections. Together, the 30 streets and 30 intersections make up Portland's high crash network. In addition to using crash data to identify dangerous streets, the task force set clear direction, as you saw in the vision statement, to rely on equity data. Equity data has zeroed in on areas of Portland with higher concentrations of more vulnerable communities. This equity data, titled Communities of Concern, is borrowed from TriMet. It is a composite index made up of 10 equity indicators, such as low-income households, people of color, people with disabilities, youth, older adults, among others. People living in these communities may have fewer choices about how, when, and where they travel, putting them at a higher risk as they move around Portland. And this is what it looks like when the high crash network and communities of concern are overlapped. The task force was clear about prioritizing Vision Zero investments where this overlap occurs. Using traffic crash data, the project team dug deeper into understanding the causes of the really serious crashes on Portland streets. As highlighted by the High Crash Network, we know that street design, particularly multi-lane, higher-speed streets, contribute to serious crashes, with 57% of fatal crashes taking place on our High Crash Network that you saw on the previous slide. Impairment contributes to 56% of fatalities on Portland streets. Speed contributes to 47%. And other dangerous behaviors like aggressive and reckless driving contribute to 51% of fatalities on Portland streets. The data was really helpful in focusing where we need to invest our resources. So let's talk a little bit more about street design. Wide multi-lane streets with longer signal spacing, faster speeds, have more serious crashes. Portland's high crash network, so these 30 streets that we've seen, they make up only 8% of our street network here in the city, and yet they account for 57% of the deaths. So that gives us, you know, a pretty good geographic focus with the work ahead of us. Of course, there's an interplay between characteristics of street and behaviors on those streets. On these arterials, it's easy to drive too fast and engage in other dangerous behaviors. And people walking and biking are put at a greater risk. So street design, it can exacerbate driver mistakes and it can encourage safe behavior. Once we had a grasp on where the serious crashes were happening and the factors contributing to them, the project team and the task force members took Vision Zero to the streets, engaging Portlanders. Through nearly 20 outreach events, monthly email newsletters, and a survey offered in four languages, we consistently heard from Portlanders a strong desire for infrastructure to improve safety and accessibility, a call for more education about safe driving, and a sense of urgency for leaders and the agencies that support them to work together to aggressively pursue this goal. Some colleagues and I, we spent a morning during the morning commute out at 82nd and Division just talking to people who are walking to the bus stop, walking to PCC, riding their bikes if they're stopped at a traffic signal, and we heard a consistent, repeated desire for streets that support safe crossings and access to transit. We've talked about where deadly crashes are happening and what's contributing to them: street design, impairment, speed, and dangerous behaviors. The task force and the technical advisory committee spent a year working through the identified best practices to address these causes. We started with a very extensive list. The task force, we had great conversations, a lot of collaboration to develop the refined list of 32 actions that's put forward in the plan that's in front of you. And we spent each of our six meetings prioritizing, refining, reworking actions until we got to the 32 that were unanimously agreed upon by the task force. As a data-driven plan, most of the actions target one of the four causes of deadly and serious injury crashes that we've reviewed. The task force added a fifth category that you'll see at the bottom of this list, engagement and accountability, in order to capture some of the important education and data collection actions that aren't tied to just one cause. And so therefore was born the five categories from which the actions flow. We won't go through each of the 32 actions. You'll be glad to hear that. you have the plan in front of you, and you can reference them there. I do want to reinforce that some actions are underway or coming soon, as Director Treat has highlighted, and others will require additional resources in order to implement. Thanks to the funding dedicated by City Council, by Portland voters with the gas tax, and other funding sources, the city is building out capital safety improvements on the high crash network. 122nd and East Burnside are under construction as we speak. Pedestrian safety is being scoped on MLK. Foster Road and West Burnside are moving toward construction, and we're developing a safety design for Outer Halsey. Last year, the state legislature granted Portland authority to roll out speed cameras, and as Director Treat mentioned, they've been very effective on BH Highway so far. We've also worked with the Oregon Speed Zone Control Board to gain approval to use safety metrics in an expedited process when we apply for reduced speed on Portland streets. That was a big win, really getting away from looking at kind of vehicle metrics to looking at safety metrics for setting those speeds. In addition, we've worked closely with other city bureaus on a number of actions to date, and I want to highlight just a few examples. We've really been impressed by city bureau staff coming to our team saying, we want to be a part of Vision Zero, and we think this is how we can do it. BES has created a driver safety program integrating Vision Zero messaging and is traveling through the Portland metro region to present it to their 120 contractors, subcontractors, and suppliers, and they're distributing Vision Zero materials with that. Bureau of Planning and Sustainability has collaborated in developing one of the actions in the dangerous behaviors section, Action D7, to improve the safety of heavy trucks, and they'll be a key partner in implementation of that. Fire, under the leadership of Chief Myers, has been an active participant on the task force, participated in the World Day of Remembrance of Traffic Victims 10 days ago, and is collaborating on focused education campaigns. Police has played a significant role with active participation on the task force and on our technical advisory committee and partnering on implementation of several actions. Fleet is working with us to place Vision Zero safety bumper stickers on city cars and trucks. Government relations, of course, is playing a key role in legislative priorities. And there are others we could mention as well. And so it's really becoming a true city collaborative effort. So there's a lot underway already, and we have a lot of work ahead of us. The next three slides highlight actions that we'll be seeking additional resources to implement. In addition to building capital safety improvements on two streets and five intersections each year, the action plan also calls for improving street design to support safe speeds in conjunction with lowering posted speeds on streets. We know that street design is going to play an important role to bring those speeds down, and we can't just repost the speed and expect to achieve compliance. As you can see, we've had a lot of success in reducing both crashes and top-end speeding with road reorganizations throughout Portland. These are three examples. So we know that street design can do a lot to encourage the safe behaviors that we need on our roadways. Portland has an impressive Safe Routes to School program in our K-8 schools, but it's not yet in the high schools. Pairing Safe Routes to School with Vision Zero to work with high school students is a perfect opportunity to connect with emerging drivers and students with increased independence as they're getting around. Leveraging our successful Safe Routes program to engage with and empower youth leadership in traffic safety is a high priority. Finally, the task force is eager to pursue an education action tied to impairment that aims to prevent impaired drivers from getting behind the wheel. So one thing that we learned through this process is that when drivers are cited for DUI, they're asked where the last place was that they were drinking. And the heat map shown on this slide is from those responses, and it's showing that concentrated areas of establishments are tied to over-serving alcohol. So this action gives us a way to work with targeted areas to prevent impaired drivers from getting behind the wheel. Given that 56% of traffic fatalities involve impairment, we're eager to get started. And then I want to wrap up with a final slide. Through all of the data analysis, statistics, and actions refinement, we've continually come back to the heart of Vision Zero, the people whose lives have been extinguished too young. Dustin's story is representative of so many of the other Portland tragedies. Dustin, a vulnerable road user who was riding his bike, was killed on Southeast Division, a street that's part of Portland's high crash network, by a drunk driver, one of the top risky behaviors. So far this year, I'll reiterate what you've already heard, 38 community members, friends, family members have been lost to traffic violence on Portland streets. 38 too many, and a daily reminder of how urgent the work is with Vision Zero. We deeply appreciate the leadership that Council has provided in advancing Vision Zero, and we look forward to your continued support as we move into implementation. Thanks.
A couple questions? Thank you for an excellent report. And Lee, I have two questions for you. First, one of the things I like about the Vision Zero plan you're coming to us with today is it's holistic and it's fully integrating. It's got all these different components. But as you have learned during your time here, at budget time, we're not always able to fund everything the way you would like, and therefore sometimes we have to make choices. I want to just see if we can do a force ranking just so I have a sense of what you think is, of all the tools in the kit, the ones that are the most effective at getting at some of the problems. So you've identified in the presentation potentially reducing speeds, beefing up and targeting enforcement, beefing up and expanding education and outreach, and then capital improvements to make roads safer for all users. Again, at budget time, when you come in, we don't say, okay, we'll give you $2, $3, $4, $5, and then you get the whole package. We look for grant money, our money, federal money, whatever. But of those four approaches, if you only had a dollar to spend,
I can do this.
Well, yeah, I figured you could. Just so we have a sense of, in relative terms, what gives us the biggest return. Obviously, I like the holistic approach, but since we're going to have to make choices in the short term, where do you put that first dollar?
Again, all of the approaches are necessary, and I love all of my children equally. So I would ask or recommend to City Council that our investments focus on road diets and reengineering the roadways. I think that's going to have the most impact on slowing people down and preventing injuries and fatalities. But I recommend it for a second reason. When we go in and do roadway reorganizations, we are actually improving the livelihood of communities. We are supporting businesses, and we're making Portland more livable by giving people places to walk, places to bike, people to get to transit, and it's really supporting livability in our community.
That's a great answer. Thank you. The second question I want to ask you is, for anyone watching or listening to this hearing, I think the couple statistics that really jump out at you. One for me is the 91% of deadly crashes traced back to speed impairment or other dangerous behaviors. Now, all of those are preventable. All of those involve conscious behavior, or even when you're impaired, there is a level of conscious behavior. And then when you break it down, 56% drug and alcohol related. And that's just staggering, I think. And so I keep reading the stories of people involved in DUI crashes who have had a history of DUI. And I think it's wonderful that you're going to do outreach to bar owners and the industry, and we're going to do targeted stuff. Do we need to ask the legislature for new tools?
That's a good question. And I think that there's always room for additional enforcement tools. I think we have some that are on the legislative agenda. We had the health department on our task force for this specific reason. Impairment and drug addiction, alcohol addiction are very, very profound issues that we as a transportation bureau are not going to be able to solve on our own. I don't believe that enforcement is the only answer to these types of behaviors. You need social services to intervene on addictive behaviors when people are getting behind the wheel impaired. I do think I lost my train of thought.
Mind if I add one thing?
Yeah, and maybe it'll help me remember what I was going to say.
Well, Leah's gathering thoughts. One area that a lot of data supported one of our actions, Action I-5, was about increasing access to the DUI Intensive Supervision Program, the DISP program. And this is something that maybe even Judge Todd could speak to. I believe he's planning to speak today. And Judge Todd and other experts in the room really agreed that if you can do a diversion program and can do it early enough with first, second, third-time offenders, it's a very effective tool, and the research supports that. There is some complexities in the way that the law is currently written, and I won't go into the various measures, but we're committed to working on that through this action item with the court systems to make that more accessible and hopefully funded program.
So I think almost all of us here can tell stories about having people with substance abuse problems within our families, particularly alcohol. And so I am entirely sympathetic to the idea that it's a for many people, it's something that can be treated and addressed. The problem is our society has had a very poor record of actually following through and funding those kinds of things.
Yes.
We had a big, to-do about community-based mental health facilities when we closed larger facilities, and what we ended up was putting a lot of people on the sidewalk. So in a perfect world, what you say makes sense, but I still, when I read about the person that's been involved in the second, third, or fourth DUI and they kill someone, the thing that I think the average person reacts by saying, why the hell do they still have a car? And if you come back and say, well, we've got to be careful about not, targeting people who are vulnerable or whatever, I get that. I get the screen. But we have to come back to why the hell are people in the car? And life is unfair, but if someone is repeatedly putting the public at risk, why the hell are they still getting into a car?
Well, we can trade stories, I think, but one of the things, just give you an example. I did a ride-along with Traffic Division one night, and we pulled a gentleman over for DUI. And when we took him in to do his booking, he had been arrested previously 34 times for DUI. He was out on a suspended license. He's on parole, and it was his 34th time. So I was talking to the officer about this. I mean, my mind was blown. This is absolutely, just mind-blowing to me. There are all sorts of resources that we need to bring to bear to solve these issues. There are upstream issues, right? We need to do the addiction recovery prevention program, but there's also downstream. There are limited resources in our jail. They don't have enough spaces in the jail if we think that enforcement and incarceration is the answer, so they triage the people that are in there. You have repeated offenders that they let go because of their triaging space in their jail. And so until that person actually causes harm to another, they're going to be back out on our streets. And I don't know that we don't have the resources necessary to address that all at once. So I think I'm just saying all this to say that there is a huge spectrum of solutions that we need to be working on. That's why our task force was so big. That's why we have brought so many people to the table, and that we all need to be thinking collectively about upstream, current, and downstream approaches to impaired driving. And the other thing that I remembered I was going to say is if you think about Mothers Against Drug Driving, was incredibly effective at the time that it came out, and it's because there was a strong group of people who socially stigmatized a behavior, and it had prevalent communication, but it also had enforcement on the back end.
Commissioner, may I add a comment to that? I don't disagree with you at all that somebody with repeated DUIs should not get into a car. But as Director Treat just kind of suggested, even if people's licenses are suspended or taken away, that doesn't physically prevent them from getting into a car. And in general, I think Judge Tao will tell you this, in sort of law enforcement, swiftness and certainty of sanction are more important than the severity. So even though, again, I would not object to it, but even if you increased the penalties on people for drunk driving, people who do irrational things tend to keep on doing irrational things, hoping they're not going to get caught. There is one way to reduce excessive drinking across the board, which is to raise the price of alcohol. And we as a city are prohibited from imposing an alcohol tax by state law. The city of Chicago, faced with a similar preemption relating to tobacco taxes, decided that, well, I think that they passed a law saying they were going to try to adopt a tobacco tax, but if it turned out to be preempted, they were simply going to mandate that the price of cigarettes go up. Not a tax, simply that the price of cigarettes go up. So that is actually an option that I had been planning to pursue if I'd gotten reelected, which I will to you. The idea of the city passing a law which raises the price of alcohol in order to deter excessive drinking and therefore DUIs.
In the same spirit here, I think we're all frustrated at the number of fatalities and accidents, and I sort of have a laundry list of ideas that I've played around with. You may not want to write them down because I usually get laughed at when I mention them. But one idea is...
Not today.
Okay.
Not that
what about, I mean, we know that drunk drivers get right behind the wheel and drive,
yeah,
license suspended or not. So I've often thought maybe one solution to that would be to require that you display a valid driver's license in order to purchase gasoline. So throw that out there for consideration. Secondly, and I think, Commissioner Nova, you kind of alluded to this maybe in your opening remarks. I mean, technology is such today that I also think why or could we, and again, I get a lot of laughter when I raise this idea, but could we jam cell phones within, say, 250 feet of high crash intersections, except for 911 calls? I think somehow there's probably a way to do that technologically, whether it's meets acceptance, or even I'd go so far as to say even along our high crash corridors.
Yes.
Jam all cell phone coverage.
And that's technically feasible. I think I saw Maurice in the room here, but I was part of the Smart Cities team, and we did ask that question of Waze, and we asked that question of other cell phones. It is technically, not only technically feasible to jam it or to provide notice, but it's technically feasible to shut it down.
Yeah.
Now, okay. Whether they're willing to do that or not is another story. And Waze was testing kind of a push notification in I think it was Jakarta, in somewhere, you know, not in North America. They were willing to have the conversation, but they weren't there yet in terms of the technology because of their business model, you know. But I think if we continue to work through the National Vision Zero Network, we continue to work through the National Smart Cities Collective, and we cross those things of working with our technology partners with putting safety first, we could get there.
Margie, so, can I just, to Dan's point, it sounds like an intriguing idea, but what do you do about the person in the back seat that's on the cell phone?
I don't know.
What do you do about the person that's on an emergency call, sitting in the passenger seat? I mean, if you shut down all the cell phone traffic, I mean, as we're told, I mean, you know, some of the police officers have reminded me that there is an occasional exception where you're allowed to use your cell phone in a way that we would otherwise consider, you know, unacceptable, which is you're on the road and you see an accident and you call the emergency line. You should pull over, but there is a chance you may be stuck in traffic and can't, but you're encouraged to make that call safely. So,
and my final, you know, I realize there's a lot of what ifs associated with these suggestions.
Yeah.
And the final one, and this one I actually will be pushing for at our legislative briefing next week or 2 weeks from now, and I've raised this before every time the police come before us to talk about their enforcement missions on overtime. They know my question by heart now.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we have these photo radars now. So if we get a picture of somebody speeding and they happen to be texting or on their phone, can we also cite them for that? So I'm serious about that one.
Yeah.
That one I think we probably need legislative approval, and I'd like to see us really try that.
There is a legislative and policy answer to that question. There's a technical answer to that question. The technical answer is we do have access to the photos of people driving, and we do see quite a few people on their phones. So
right.
You can see them in the camera.
Right.
Okay. Whether we have the authority to cite them through that is an entirely different question. I don't believe we do at this time.
Okay. Those are my crazy ideas.
I wanted to comment on that piece. Some of us use the phone for the wayfinding for the route.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a positive thing, that if I'm not trying to read the very small street names that might be not very well lit,
mm-hmm.
but I've got a GPS that's telling me turn now, that's a safety thing. So I think it's a good conversation, but I think we should continue it. Do we have any statistics on when have there been any crashes involving transportation network company drivers like Uber and Lyft, etc.? And if not, could we please make sure that that's part of the annual report?
Yes.
And also, obviously, taxis, because that was part of the conversation that we had. It would be good to know how many professional drivers are in crashes and where. I did very much appreciate the report with the names on it. One of the most important things, and also one of the most difficult things that I do every year, is to go to Pioneer Courthouse Square to read the names of Holocaust survivors with the Jewish Federation. And it's really important to give the names of people who have gone to. I liked it even better that you've got the names on a map, so that this is where visually these people were killed. I'm wondering, do you have any information on crashes on the interstates? We've talked about Portland streets. Does that include, first of all the state streets, but also the interstates?
Yes. Yeah, the numbers that we looked at are fatal and serious crashes that occurred within the city of Portland on all streets owned by ODOT as well as the city of Portland.
Yeah, again, if next year there could be a breakout of which ones were on the highways, because that's where you're in some ways allowed to go faster and you don't expect to experience pedestrians or cyclists. So that would be good information. I appreciate that. I did look at the graphs, and I was wondering, why are the cyclist deaths on Broadway so much higher than the rest of the high fatality streets or crashes?
There is a, especially with biking, there's a correlation between riders per capita, like of travelers, and the amount of crashes. So what the crash map doesn't show you is how many bikes are at that point at one moment, and Broadway is one of our most popular bike routes.
And are they spread out along Broadway, or are there particular intersections that we should
look at? My memory, and Clay, if you have anything to add or anyone, let me know, is that the hot spots are on both ends of the bridgehead. And if you think about it, there's coming, you know, into downtown. There's coming off of a hill. There's kind of a blind intersection there. On the other side of Broadway is there's a lot of highway movement on and off ramps. So they're both complicated intersections at those bridgeheads, is what I remember from the crashes. Anything else on that?
Yeah, I would just add that before the bridgehead on the east side, it's also where the I-5 off-ramp is, where there have been a significant number of serious crashes.
And hopefully, as we continue to look at the data, we're going to be able to see we did this and that made a difference. I know that the cyclists having right-of-way when the cars are going onto the Broadway Bridge versus off on Williams, I think hopefully we can get some data on this worked and let's do it somewhere else as well. Mm-hmm. I noticed that 3% of establishments have 22% of the citations. Are you working with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement to perhaps report those businesses to OLCC?
So what we have not done that yet, but what we are in the process of doing is working with the OLCC to join our implementation task force, because we recognize through all this data collection analysis what a critical role they're going to play in implementation. And we're happy to include ONI if that's...
Well, yes, I know that our folks would be more than, especially now we have the cannabis program as well, and we're going to have some revenue from cannabis, so very happy to be able to work on that. I just wanted to mention to anybody watching at home who wants to do more that we have our legislative agenda priority setting meeting tonight from 6 to 9 at the Tabor space, which is 54411 Southeast Belmont. So I know we have some community organizers here and others. If you want to know, first of all, how to lobby with the legislature, and secondly, what should the city put on our legislative agenda as priorities, that's an opportunity. I think those are all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, let's do a time check. How many invited panelists do you have, and then how many people do we have signed up?
Five invited?
15 people signed up.
15? Oh, okay. Okay, thank you very much. We'll want you call your invited panelists first.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Christy Finney Dunn of Oregon and Southwest Washington Families for Safe Streets, Judd Stephen Todd of Multnomah County Circuit Court, and standing in for Chief Myers, Assistant Fire Chief Don Russ, and they'll be followed by Joanne Harrigal of Elders in Action and Noelle Milkaberry of Oregon Walks.
That means I'm first.
Go ahead. Yep.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Christy Finney Dunn. I'm part of the Vision Zero Task Force and Oregon and Southwest Washington's Families for Safe Streets. You already heard my son's story featured, and that was very difficult for me, but I just want to say that two men were actually struck at the time that my son was killed. One was injured, and my son obviously died. They were riding in a bike lane, and an 18-year-old drunk driver hit and run them. Dustin was a college student. He was an advocate for equality for all people, and he was a son who said, "I love you, Mom," at every opportunity. I wasn't prepared emotionally or financially to bury my son, but when tragic crashes happen, you have to deal with them whether you're ready or not and whether you know how to or not. In the midst of mind-blowing grief and confusion, you must figure it out quickly. After the death of my son, I learned what real crying is. It's your body producing more tears than you ever thought imaginable, and it's making sounds like a wounded animal. It's breath stealing and stomach churning and heart clenching, and it's fearing that at times you may never be able to stop crying. I quickly learned that about 100 people per day are killed in the U.S., and I hadn't even noticed before. After hearing of a crash, I'd feel bad for a few seconds and then move on just like the news did. I didn't think anything would ever happen to my family. I didn't even think about it seriously until it did. And I've learned that studies that drivers engage in behaviors they don't want other drivers to, because they believe they can handle it. They believe that they can drive unsafely because it's not unsafe for them, because they're better drivers. And so we get to Vision Zero. The zero in Vision Zero represents real people, not just a number. What may seem more realistic to people, say Vision 100, is to imply that 100 people killed or injured is okay. We're good with that. Well, who are these 100 people whose lives are dispensable, whose loved ones grieving is acceptable? Are those who think that whatever number is more reasonable than zero all right if one of that number is someone they care about? What is more important than the safety of our family members, our coworkers, our neighbors, the person who takes care of our children, who delivers our food and serves our coffee? Zero. There are all kinds of ways to suffer from traffic collisions. I work in social services and daily talk to families on TANF cash assistance or food stamps because a car crash has resulted in injuries, lost jobs, homelessness, loss of transportation, addiction, and mental health problems. You passed a resolution to work toward Vision Zero, and I ask that you continue in that endeavor. We expect that you will keep this commitment and do what you must to make it happen, and happen quickly. And I heard this mentioned already, and I'm very excited about it, but what I have here is make every city employee driving a city vehicle be an example of how cars should be driven, including the police. Require your employees who drive city vehicles to take one or more of the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough classes, the Save the Road or Share the Road class, the Safety Belt class, High Risk Driver class. This teaches them the why and how of driving safely, and nearly everyone who takes that class, those classes, recommend that other people should, and I speak on victim panels for three of those classes. Families for Safe Streets members speak from tragic personal knowledge of why Vision Zero is crucial, as well as Dustin. Tracy was killed in a bike lane. Joe and Danielle were struck down in marked crosswalks. Cindy's husband, Marcos, died after being T-boned by a speeding driver, and Alexis fatally crashed while using her cell phone. Don't let more families qualify for our Families for Safe Streets group. While we continue to wait, the time is now, it's urgent, and it's imperative. Thank you for all of your work. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Judge?
Thank you. Well, I want to thank the commissioners, particularly Commissioner Novick, for your leadership. And because of that, we have an excellent PBOT staff, and they pulled off an amazing project. It was such a thrill to be involved with that. I'm one of the judges in traffic court. A lot of Portlanders don't know that Portland doesn't have municipal court. Gresham doesn't have a municipal court. The circuit court handles all those traffic cases, and there are a lot. And I've lost track, about 100,000 tickets I lost track. And I meet a lot of people in court. In fact, I've met some of you. And I'll tell you, I learn a lot from the letters I read and the people that I meet. And in my 19 years of doing this, I've learned that it's very hard to change people's behavior. Courts and laws and police are just not enough. We don't have enough police, but even if we did, it's not enough to change people's behavior. We need other solutions. We need education, engineering, and emergency services as well. New laws are not going to work if they're hard to enforce, and police find that they're hard to enforce. They're not going to work unless drivers and cyclists and pedestrians know about these laws and understand these laws, and that's a major problem in Oregon. New laws are not going to work if drivers, cyclists, and pedestrians don't know the reasons behind the laws and why it's so important to follow them. In fact, I think some of you may have seen a brochure that's been produced that shows that your likelihood of killing somebody is so much higher at 40 miles an hour than 20 miles an hour, even 30 miles an hour. 10 miles an hour can make a big difference, but most drivers don't understand that, and that's part of the reason we have such a speeding problem in Portland. I think education of all our road users is crucial, and it's a crucial part of this plan. It's a problem statewide. I think it's terrible. I think it's unforgivable that someone can get their license and drive for 50, 60, 70 years without ever having any more education about all the new laws that are passed and all the new hazards that arise. And I see this every day in court that are just shocked to find out about all these new laws that are 10, 20 years old, but they never heard about them and they're not aware of them. I think we need to educate all drivers, not just when they're brand new, but throughout their driving history. And that also includes cyclists and pedestrians. We have a lot of new challenges in Portland for road users, particularly involving cyclists and pedestrians, and we're seeing a lot of our deaths are those groups rather than motorists. The city can improve our infrastructure, but we need to educate road users on how to use our streets safely. You can put in rapid flashing beacons. You can put in new safety devices and new bike lanes and bike boxes and sharrows and all kinds of other things. But unless people know what they are, they're not going to be using them effectively, and we're still going to have traffic deaths. I think distracted driving is the worst problem we're going to face in the future. It's much more prevalent than we can prove with our research because it's very difficult. I thought it was interesting in questions about the photographs. I do see people in their cars going through red lights and photographs using their phones, so we know that it happens. It's not enough to prohibit use of a cell phone while driving. The important thing is drivers need to know how dangerous it really is and how much it can cause crashes. Until people see the reason for those laws, they're going to try and cheat and do it themselves, and that results in crashes. Well, Vision Zero, I hope you realize, it's not just a plan. It's a process. It really is a process and should be a process. And I'm really excited that the task force is going to continue. We're going to continue to meet and share information, share ideas, and evaluate what's happening and what progress we've made, and then improve the plan. It's not a static thing. It's going to improve and change with the meetings that we have. The partnership that the city has put together is just amazing. It's a powerful force for traffic safety, and I really want to thank you for supporting that partnership.
Thank you. Question?
Certainly.
And just for the record, I don't think you and I have met in your courtroom or outside of your courtroom, but I'm struck by what you said earlier about not having updates to driver ed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm particularly struck because I got a notice in the mail within the last month saying I have to re-up my registration. And as part of that, I got to take my car to a DEQ facility to have it checked out. So it's interesting. We put more of a premium on having my car checked out than to have me updated in terms of my driver education. So that's a very interesting comment you made. But since you are the expert in the courtroom enforcing the law, are there any changes in the law that would make your job easier? Or would give you more tools to be effective in what you care about?
I think we have the tools other than basic resources. What we need is to be able to send more people to traffic schools, and we're doing a lot of that. And the police have really supported us with that. That we're sending more and more drivers to driver education programs. And it's really amazing because one person going to that program will tell 10 friends about the laws they learned about and the hazards they learned. They'll tell people about what cyclists faced. It's really amazing how that just blossoms and blooms. So I think what we're doing now is working well. Now, I think the police bureau needs a lot more resources to do what they're doing. The traffic division is doing an awesome job, but they don't have nearly enough to do their jobs.
Chief Russ.
Commissioners, my name is Don Russ, Special Operations Deputy Chief, Port of Fire and Rescue. On behalf of Chief Myers, we are in support of Vision Zero. I was on the task force personally. It was a great task force. I was educated through the process. As emergency responders, our members see and experience firsthand the deadly and serious impacts of traffic violence that occur to our citizens on our streets. It's tragic. And we as an organization, we agree with Commissioner Novick's message in the plan that our citizens deserve safe streets to walk, bike, operate mobility devices, and access transit and drive. This year alone, Portland Fire and Rescue has responded to over 900 traffic crashes involving pedestrians, bicycles, and motor vehicles. And as the director stated and informed you, the council, that, you know, we're at 38 people have died on the streets this year. We surpassed last year's a number of 37, so we're trending upward, and that is a concern. So it's our desire to partner with Portland Bureau of Transportation to meet the objectives of this plan through community outreach and road design agreements. Our public education office has been connecting with the community for decades to advocate the message of fire and life safety. These educational resources can be used to deliver the Vision Zero message to neighborhoods, specifically to high crash networks and communities of concern. It's our desire to utilize our members in the field to deliver this concept outlined, these concepts outlined in this plan. We can do this by just taking our companies in service, move them out to the areas where there's going to be an outreach community event, post the vehicle there. We're already working on some tools through brochures between the two bureaus with our public education office as we speak. Develop some tools to give to equip our people in the field to just get the message out of the plan. We also understand in order to meet these goals of the plan, there is some road design changes that must occur in the high impact areas. This concerns me as a Special Operations Deputy Chief. Many of these road design changes come across my desk weekly. I'm working closely with the engineers, and we're working collaboratively to try to make some concessions at Portland Fire and Rescue. You know, for years this has been a challenge with us when we talk about speed tables and And now we use speed cushions and for calming devices. So concessions are made. Commissioner Myers is very big on walkability scores and safe streets, and this is very important to him. And so he is, when he caught wind of this plan, right when he got here, he's only been here since April, this interested him. He came from St. Charles, well, he came from the Midwest, and walkability scores were very poor over there. And he really embraces the fact that you can walk on these streets, but he wants them to be safe for both bicyclists and